Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Brewers podcast, coming at you at the end, at least for the Brewers, of the 2021 baseball season. By now you know, Milwaukee fell to the Atlanta Braves 3-1 in the National League Division Series. Their offense went ice cold, back-to-back 3-0 shutouts, followed by a frustrating 5-4 loss on an 8th-inning home run by Freddie Freeman against Josh Hader, bounces Milwaukee from the postseason. Their year is over. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast, and on the other line, as always, is Tom Haudricourt, Brewers beat reporter, covering this team for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Tom, we'll visit some of the bigger picture stuff, because there is quite a bit to unpack with the Brewers. We'll quickly look back at these games here, mainly game four, the one that the Brewers twice had leads of 2 runs, gave them back in the bottom half inning. You had written at jsonline.com that the pitching really kind of let them down. They had, I would think, the matchup they would want at the end of the game. Josh Hader on the mound against a lefty swinger, Freddie Freeman, and Freeman with 2 outs and nobody on hits the decisive home run. Second time in 3 years that Josh Hader's been on the mound in the 8th inning for a late lead seeding. I feel like that's still a little bit of bad luck. I mean, Freddie Freeman just is a good hitter, but
Said that, you know, their pitching let them down a little bit. I wasn't talking so much about that, JR, as the things that happened with the first 4 runs that Atlanta scored.
Right.
You know, you go back to that 4th inning, and Eric Lauer is cruising. You know, he's really cruising. And it's the Brewers have scored, finally, you know, broke the seal in the top of the inning and scored 2 runs. Finally got some hits with runners in scoring position, of which they had 0. For the first 3 games. And then Lauer's got a runner on and 2 outs, and he's facing the bottom of the order, and he walks Travis d'Arnaud. That was a bad one. And then he nicks Heredia with a pitch. And now all of a sudden, you should have, you know, against their 2 worst hitters, now they have the bases loaded. And so Council decides, you know, he's seen enough of that. And he brings Hunter Strickland in, and Hunter Strickland had been so good all year, particularly with inherited runners. I think he had only allowed like 4 of 15. And he throws an 0-2 pitch that Eddie Rosario lines into center field for a 2-run single. That can't happen. You can't give up an 0-2 hit there. You got to bounce a couple of pitches or something, but you just can't, that can't happen. And now all of a sudden it's tied 2-2. And a lot of the air gets let out of the balloon of finally cracking the seal. And then, lo and behold, Rowdy Tellez, you know, hits his 2nd 2-run homer of the series and puts them back up by 2. And they're in kind of a bind in their bullpen because they're missing Brent Suter and Devin Williams. So they try to get a couple of innings out of Aaron Ashby. And Aaron Ashby's going to be a very good pitcher for the Brewers, I would think. He's got a lot of talent, but that's a tough position for a kid. And he had some soft contact in that inning. And then he issues a walk and hits a batter, too, down at the bottom of the order again.
Another 0-2 pitch on that hit batsman, too.
Yes. So, and now all of a sudden they score 2 runs off of him. You know, just thought, you know, and that inning, JR, showed the difference between putting the ball in play and not putting the ball in play. They had all kinds of soft contact, but Jock Peterson delivers a run with a force out grounder to short that wasn't hit hard enough to turn a double play. That's how soft it was. And then d'Arnaud again punches an opposite field grounder, you know, pass. Diving Tellez at first base to tie the game. So it wasn't like he was getting murdered to death, but the Braves did show how much difference it can make to put the ball in play. The Brewers struck out 48 times in 4 games. It's just incredibly high rate and unacceptable. And it's why they had so much trouble scoring runs and why they were so bad with runners in scoring position, because they too often struck out in those situations. So I was more talking about those innings. I'll tell you one thing, though. Brandon Woodruff stood as stout as a guy can stand to bail Ashby out of his last inning and then pitch a scoreless 7th. And then they just decided, you know, the best hitters were coming up for Atlanta in the 8th inning. So they just decided Josh Hader or bust. And it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, for sure. You're talking about the bottom of the order. You could go back even to game three, where it's the 7, 8, 9 hitters who score the three runs against Adrian Hauser, 7 and 8 with singles. And then Jock Peterson as a pinch hitter. But again, that's because they lose that game because there's no margin for error. The Brewers offense wasn't giving them anything. And it seemed like every button they pushed, whether it was going to Ashby, whether it was, and this ultimately became because Corbin Burns wasn't available, but whether it was, you know, starting somebody other than Corbin Burns or taking Freddie Peralta out in game three because you desperately need that offense and not having that turn into an inning-ending situation. Right. And then not taking out Eric Lauer in game four and then him being needed to be taken out the following half inning. It just felt like the world was against the Brewers in this series. It comes back to guys just not hitting the ball, like you said, the strikeouts, the inability to hit in situational spots. But, you know, I feel like even in game four when they had leads, it felt like they never grasped control of anything in that series.
Let's be fair and say Atlanta didn't exactly take apart the Brewers pitching.
No.
You know? They pitched great for the most part. I think their starters had a 1.69 ERA in the four games. That should be better than going 1-3. You know what? Well, 1.69 ERA, call me old-fashioned, if you will, but that should be better than going 1-3. And the other thing is, you know, more so before Devin Williams and Suter were lost, it looked like the Brewers had a tremendous advantage in the bullpen area. Yet Atlanta scored off of the Brewers' bullpen, and the Brewers didn't score off of Atlanta's bullpen. And no offense to A.J. Mentor or
Tyler Matzek.
I mean, come on.
You know? A lot of those grooved pitches again. You know, we talked about that on the last podcast. Tyler Matzek, obviously great in the series, but, like, the Brewers have got to hit that guy.
Yeah, they just kept using him over and over and over again, and they kept not hitting him. You know, at least Luke Jackson, you know, statistically, had a great season. And then Will Smith, you know, he's the perils of Pauline closer, you know, and he gave them opportunities to at least draw even in the games he pitched. It's not like he, you know, had a dominant year. He piled up a lot of saves, but he almost always did it by the skin of his teeth. He's the left-handed K-Rod, you know, not comfortable until the bases are loaded. And he manages to make it work. But you got to score some runs against those guys. You know?
Absolutely.
You must score some runs against those guys. And they just didn't do it. And there's a lot of blame to spread offensively. But let's go to the top of the Brewers lineup. Colton Wong, one hit, the leadoff hitter. Christian Yelich, the number three hitter, 3 for 15. And then the cleanup hitter, Avisaíl García, one hit. Adames, I think, had 4 or 5 hits. He didn't drive in any runs, but at least he competed and didn't strike out all the time. But when you have three of your top four guys do nothing, good luck with that offense. You know, if Rowdy Tellez doesn't hit two-run homers, they only score 2 runs in the 4 games. I mean, he was, what's 4/6, whatever that fraction is?
That's 2/3.
Yeah, he was 67% of their offense, right?
Indeed, yes, and we will talk at great length here about Christian Yelich in a moment, but wanted to touch real quickly on, it's a little moot because we learned that Corbin Burns simply didn't feel physically he was able to start that game. Right. I know there's a lot of conversation about, well, the Braves are starting Charlie Morton on short rest. The Brewers should do something similar to put their best pitcher out there. Philosophically, maybe I'm the only one who feels this way. I fully understand you want to do everything you can to win that day. But the Brewers, their goals are not to get to game five of the NLDS. Their goal is to get beyond the NLDS. So if, let's say, Corbin Burns was healthy, I feel like game four and game five have to be on similar footing. I get there's no game five without game four. Of course, I understand that. Right. But having Corbin Burns on full rest for potentially 7 or 8 innings of game five, I feel like is a pretty good idea if you are billing yourself as a team that has all this pitching depth, has Brandon Woodruff available out of the pen or Freddie Peralta or even Eric Lauer and Adrian Hauser. I mean, this is a team that should be built for that specific situation.
Yeah. So let me address that whole concept. First of all, they lined their rotation up so that Burns would pitch games 1 and 5, you know, they expected Atlanta to give him a fight. You know, they were prepared to go 5 games but we're going to have a fully rested Corbin Burns in games 1 and 5. So what's wrong with that plan, JR? Tell me the flaw in that plan.
No, that sounds great.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for agreeing with me. The other thing is, let's move forward to game 4. How did Charlie Morton look on short rest? How did he look?
I mean, they were able to get to him far better than they were in game 1 when he was on regular rest.
And he was gone in the fourth inning. You know? So Lauer matched him, you know. So and here's the other thing is, Charlie Morton was pitching on one day short rest, and he still didn't look very good. Corbin Burns would have been pitching on 2 days short rest because they used a 6-man rotation all year, and he had his body conditioned to be ready for that. Could he have maybe gone out there and tried to cover it? People said, well, why? Woodruff did it. Yes, he did it for one inning. Corbin Burns was – they wouldn't want him to be an opener, you know it? If they started him, they'd want some innings out of it. You know, it's just, you know, I think the phrase comparing apples and oranges is pretty overused, but we're talking about apples and oranges there. You know, it's not the same thing. And if Charlie Martin had pitched 6 innings at age 37 and given up no runs and looked fantastic, then you can just fire all kinds of shots at the Brewers for not being, but he didn't do it, you know. And now I don't think they're going to be able to have him. I think Atlanta, from what I saw, I don't think he's going to pitch till game 3 of the NLCS now. Because guess what? He's old and tired.
Yes, they do have Max Fried for game 1. You know, they do have that 1-2 punch. So that's fine for them. But we'll see in game 2 how they feel about it. But yes, I'm very much on the same plane with you. I would stats show that guys who start on short rest in the playoffs, it doesn't work out for them all that well. And yeah, there's anecdotal outliers or whatever, but you know, Corbin Burns would have probably been able to give you at best five, six innings in that game. If everything works perfectly, I think you want him for 7 or 8. You talked about the bullpen shortages, no Devin Williams, no Brent Suter. You can't put this ball in anybody else's hands. It's gotta be Corbin Burns. Might as well have him at full strength for game 5, which is, you know, the goal is to get beyond that game anyway, not just get to game 5.
You got no business losing 3 games in a row and getting shut out in 2 of them.
Not with this pitching staff. I mean, the pitching staff could set you up for success, and they did. You got to score some runs. So we will, one of the biggest parts of the offense, you just talked about it, Christian Yelich, and you wrote about it again at jsonline.com. This is not a problem that has an obvious solution. And when you've written about that, they've said this over and over again. Nobody knows what's really wrong with Christian Yelich. Up and down the Brewers swear it is not a physical issue. His numbers were worse than they have ever been. This is going back to his rookie season. He's paired with a hitting coach that knows him from back then, from his rookie season. Yeah. So it seems like the ideal arrangement. He's a guy who was MVP caliber in both 2018 and 2019. And then he's just different. I mean, single digit home runs from a guy who had a couple injury stints, but, you know, played most of the season. This baffling situation, whether it's mental, whether the knee injury that he sustained in late 2019 is still playing in his swing, whether there's some mechanical issue, I would anecdotally say he also kind of looks different in the outfield. He's just not as quick to the ball. He kind of looks like somebody compared him to Corey Hart later in his career. And I feel that it's kind of a damning comparison. Corey Hart kind of famously fell off a cliff pretty quickly. They paid a lot of money to this guy. And the concern now is that they may not be able to fill out the rest of a roster if they've got this contract and this production tied to it. What level of concern should people feel? I know they still say they have faith in Christian Yelich rebounding, but it's an albatross if he's unable to do so. And I guess if I'm a Brewers fan, I'm pretty concerned at this point.
Well, I wrote an entire, you know, so we had, on Friday morning, we had David Stern's final press conference. I let Todd Rosiak do bullet point every single thing but Yelich. And I wrote just only on Yelich, my Sunday column, which is already up on JS Online, posted online. It'll be in Sunday's paper. But that's how strong I felt about it. And I believe the headline of the column is something to the Brewers have only one priority this winter, fix Christian Yelich. You know?
Yes.
I mean, You know, they had to gulp hard to give him $26 million a year if he was the old Christian Yelich. They still had to gulp hard. That's way higher than they've ever paid any player, and they're going to do it for 7 years. And it represents 25% of the payrolls that they've been averaging. You know, they've been averaging $100 million payrolls. So it's a big but. They only felt they could do it because they're controlling so many of their other players. And also, they thought he was one of the best players in baseball when they gave it to him. So even Yelich on top of their game, it's a huge financial commitment. But Yelich struggling at the plate, it's a disaster. It's a budgetary disaster. And so they've got to figure it out. You know, nobody works any harder than Christian Yelich. I watched him do it, maybe too hard. But I think it became mentally defeating. He looked the worst he'd looked all year at the end. Don't you agree? I mean, it was so symbolic that their season ended with him taking a called third strike. Couldn't even swing at the last pitch he saw. So he looked mentally fried. We talked to him after the game. He seemed very mentally fried and defeated. And I think the end of the season didn't come too soon for him, because I think he needs a break and then just try to regroup. You know, it was asked one more time today, anything physically wrong with him? No. You know, we asked ad nauseum on that. And so it's almost more concerning that the answer keeps being no, because if it was yes, at least you'd know what was going on. But he is really mechanically messed up. So I have an incredible stat that I have in my Sunday column. I believe I don't have my notes right here, but I believe it was last 43 plate appearances, no extra base hit and only two fly balls.
That's wild. And I was going to say that it isn't so much. Obviously his home run production has fallen off a cliff. He had one home run in the final month plus the playoffs. He doesn't even get the ball off the ground. I mean, everything. And he's always hit a lot of ground balls. That's always been part of his game.
Right.
But this is almost uncanny. Like, this is almost beyond explanation.
It is. And, you know, his hard hit rate is still as good as it's ever been. And he hits a lot of hard ground balls. But you don't see many hard ground balls go for home runs. And it leads to a lot of ground into double plays if he hits. You know, they play him. They shift him up the middle a lot, just like so many hitters get shifted. And he hit into a key double play in that series, just a bullet right up the middle. And Dansby Swanson was playing right behind the bag and caught it, stepped on the bag, and threw over. And so it makes him very double play prone to be hitting hard ground balls. So he had some really good exit velocities, some, you know, 95 and above in that series, but it was all ground balls. And so if they go through the holes, fine, but if they go at a guy, it's an out and sometimes two outs. But so he's just so mechanically fouled up that he can't lift the ball. You know, one of the phrases we hear so much in modern baseball is launch angle. He's totally lost his, you know. And he's a mechanic. I talked to a lot of scouts in the last 3 or 4 weeks of the season, because a lot of scouts were around the team scouting for the postseason. And I all heard, well, first of all, it was general amazement from the ones who hadn't seen him in a long time at how different he looked. But they just gave me all kinds of things. But the one thing I heard over and over again, long swing, slow swing. And that definitely leads to not much power. So they've got to figure it out. If he is healthy, and they say he is, then it's mechanical or mental or both, and they've got to figure it out.
Yeah, I think it's, even if he's healthy, I think it wouldn't be unfair to think the injury he sustained in 2019, this somehow resulted from that, whether it's the time off or the mental aspect or the mechanical aspect, like just something flipped at that point. Because
I think it's a confluence of things, JR, and all of that stuff. I think the broken kneecap, COVID ball, the weirdness of COVID ball, in which so many hitters looked out of sorts, then the bad back this year. I just think it's been so many starts and stops for him. And plus, is the knee still bothering, or is it in his head that he doesn't want to hit another ball off of it, and so he's done some different things mechanically? Has the back locked him up? Even though it doesn't hurt, it just locked him up. You know, a back doctor told me there's no such thing as you used to have a bad back.
Right, right. Yes, it's always evolving.
So, and he's so young too. He's 29. That's the other thing that's alarming about this. Like, Lorenzo Cain had a lot of injury problems this year, but he's 35.
Yeah, and he's still under contract for next year. Jackie Bradley Jr. is under contract for next year. I don't know how much production you can expect, especially after Bradley's season, out of either of those guys. If you throw Yelich in the mix, it's getting pretty tough pretty fast for a team that, you know, has to be smart, has traditionally tried to be smart, pinch pennies where it can. And so as far as fixing this offense, so to speak, you know, there are some pretty good pieces that are going to be back under team control on this offense, Willy Adames chief among them. But I don't know if we can expect, you know, they're going to have this great pitching staff coming back. Like David Stearns, I think, even said, they could bring back the entire rotation if they wanted to. And you know what? They don't even need to, because Aaron Ashby is going to be, in theory, a better version of Brett Anderson. So you're going to have a tremendous group. You have to have some bats to go with it. But just knowing Milwaukee's MO, knowing David Stearns' MO, quite honestly, I feel like it's going to be more fix around the fringes here. And maybe financially, they're going to feel they're not at liberty to do more than that. I don't know how, if you feel that might be different.
As I wrote in my roster story in Friday, in today's paper, Friday's paper, but online yesterday, they have 14 arbitration eligible players, including some for the first time, like Corbin Burns and Urias, Lauer and Hauser. And you know, it's that first year where you take the big leap. It's where you go from 500,000 to like 3 million, you know. And then Hader's got two more years of arbitration because he was a super two. He's at 7 million. He's projected to go to 10. You know, every year we hear that, you know, the Brewers are going to trade Josh Hader, and they never do, because guess what? It's a dumb thing to do. But, you know, can they pay all that money to their outfield, then give all those other raises to their RB guys, their starting pitchers and infielders, and then also go to 10 on Hader? Can they do it? I don't know. We're going to find out. You know, they're going to have to increase their payroll to do all of that. So, but I know this sounds weird to say this, because he's given up the winning runs the last two postseasons, not including COVID ball. But Josh Hader, I mean, I told somebody the other day, the day they trade him is the day I write they got tired of winning.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Hader a little bit more. You know, if let's say he is worth $10 million, or even a little bit more than that. For a guy as singular a talent as Josh Hader, in a vacuum, that's absolutely an acceptable amount of money for a year. You know, they paid Eric Gagne $10 million back in 2008. I mean, that was a bad contract, but like, they should, in theory, be able to handle that. But it's also, I think, one of the more interesting things is how he was used this year differently than in years past. He was used primarily, and we've talked about this, as kind of the ninth inning guy, a one inning guy who's in for saves, tie games too, but just he wasn't expanding his role to being that sort of, you know, have a lot of like versatility, be able to go multiple innings and things like that. And it seems as though that's possible, that that's partly because Josh Hader wants it that way. You know, there were some rumblings after the season that he wasn't thrilled with a couple seasons ago when the team just rubber stamped a raise for him, and he wasn't able to get that initial raise, wasn't able to get what he fully wanted in arbitration. I don't know if that's then, you know, an agreement between Hader and council, how he's used. Certainly it worked out. Like, we're talking about a guy who's probably going to win NL Reliever of the Year or Reliever of the Year. I forget if that's a league-wide or an NL award, you know, for the third time in his career. So they definitely got a ton of value out of this guy. But if there is any, I don't know, if unhappiness is probably too strong, dissatisfaction, whatever, you know, I guess that would compel a team to be more active in trying to move him, especially when they have this need for a bat. I just don't know what team is going to be able to say, here is a big league caliber bat that you can put in your starting lineup for a relief pitcher, as good as Josh Hader is. I mean, the teams at that level that want to add that closer to cap off their own playoff outlook, they're not giving up bats. You know, they're not giving up guys who are going to play for them. So I don't know what kind of deal would even, you know, I used to think that was an obvious thing too. They'd move Hader for bats. Now I don't know how much that even makes sense.
Well, first of all, I'll say I've detected, and we don't have clubhouse access, and we don't get to talk to these guys nearly as much as we used to before COVID. But I've detected no dissatisfaction from Josh Hader with his role on the team or his place on the team or his salary. All players, you know, don't like the arbitration, you know, losing. They don't like it, you know, because for one thing, that, you know, negative stuff gets brought out, you know, about you in those hearings, and they don't like it. But I mean, you have to be around Josh Hader. This guy doesn't fret over stuff like that. This guy's just as unaffected as anybody I've ever seen. And I think he thinks he's making more money than he ever dreamed he would ever make, although more is coming. And And he loved being used in the traditional ninth inning role. He loved it, you know? And so I don't think there's any rumblings of discontent that would make them think he has to be moved. And he told us a million times this was the most close-knit team he ever played on, and he just seemed to absolutely love it. So I don't really buy into anything, any under rumblings of stuff other than just what happens on the field. So, and the guy had a great year. He blew one save, you know. He gave up three homers. That home run to Freeman was the first home run to a left-handed hitter all year. You know, he hung one slider that the guy didn't take. You know what? Freeman could have fouled that ball back or just taken it. Sometimes guys just take the first pitch. And especially if he was sitting on a fastball and got a slider. But he hung a slider in a bad place to a really good hitter. The irony of that, there was a ton of irony in that game and in that series in general. But the major irony was Freeman had not hurt them in that series. They had done a great job of keeping him under wraps, you know. But he hit a bolt. That's why he's one of the best players. He's the reigning National League MVP. He's a heck of a player, and he's their guy. You know, he's their anchor, and he hit a good pitch. But if they don't do some of the funky stuff that led up to that, and that we've already talked about, and how those first four runs are scored, you know, that doesn't lose the game for them.
Yeah, it's hard to feel like the Brewers were going to win that game if they get through Hader, because remember that, let's say he gets Freddie Freeman out, it's still tied. It wasn't a double switch. Josh Hader's right. Spot leads off the inning, so he's probably right. he's not going to bat in the ninth when you need right. a run.
And the other thing that hadn't been talked probably enough about, only the Brewers can break out of a slump and go back into it in the same game. They did nothing the last four innings. Nothing. They had one guy on base in the last four innings. 14 of their final 15 batters went down, a lot of them striking out. And that goes back to what we said about how can they not score against that Atlanta bullpen? Who was going to score the one more run that needed to crack that 4-4 tie? It didn't feel like it was going to be the Brewers.
No, it sure didn't. It was kind of a bummer of a game to watch. Quite honestly, it felt like a slow. It was a long 4.5 hour game. Yeah. Felt like a little bit of a death march at the end there.
But you just didn't feel like it was going to be the Brewers that scored the winning run. I mean, they couldn't get a guy on base, and they didn't. Tellez was the only guy that hit home runs. You know, so just unfortunate. It shouldn't have come. It's kind of like that game in Washington. Hader didn't deserve that loss either. You know, so. You know, broken bats and not balls off the knobs that were called HBPs and balls that skipped past outfielders. that was a confluence of madness. This was just he hung a slider to the wrong guy.
Yeah, like you said, it ends. Eduardo Escobar pinch hits, leads off the ninth, gets on base against Will Smith, the guy who likes to pitch in traffic, and then he hangs a slider to Christian Yelich. Quite honestly, Yelich doesn't even swing at for strike three, ends the game. An appropriate end. Eduardo Escobar ties into the many guys, and like you said earlier, you wrote about these the roster decisions they have going forward. I was thinking about Eduardo Escobar as a good option for them a couple podcasts ago. The way Luis Arias, I think, closed the season and was their choice to start those last two games of the NLDS tells me that they very much value his ability to play third base, and whether or not he sticks at third base, I still think Arias is going to, he's going to be the guy going forward. I doubt the team makes a huge push for Escobar. I think Avisail Garcia is probably gone. As you look at the rest of this roster, are there particularly intriguing roster decisions they have that are, you know, that there isn't an obvious answer to at this point?
Well, and it was brought up at the season-ending debriefing with Stearns. What is the plan now with Kesson Hira, or is there one? And he indicated that he said some things that made me wonder if he's going to be the right fielder.
Yeah, I think so. Mention for a guy to mention outfield this early, you know, they're very guarded about what positions they want to use guys at. They didn't admit that they would use Ryan Braun at first base until the last second. To say outfield out loud at the end of the 2021 season says that guy's taking outfield reps starting day one spring training in 2022.
I know, and it just, you know, is that where they save $12 million by letting Garcia go and putting Hira out there? If not, I think it's going to be Tyrone Taylor, which again means a minimum salary guy. And probably he deserves to see some time too. So other than that intriguing thing about like Wither Keston Hira, just imagine instead of acquiring a bat, suppose they fixed Hira and Yelich. How much better would their offense be? It would be a lot better, an awful lot better. So that should be their goal. Fix those two guys.
That would indeed help this offense quite a bit, man.
It'd be one righty and one lefty too, you know.
I just can't believe.
But I think and we've been saying this since Prince Fielder walked out the door after the 2011 season. What are they going to do at first base? You know, this year it was, you know, supposedly Hira. That didn't last very long. Then it was Vogelbach, and then he got hurt. And then the guy that ended up doing the best was Rowdy Tellez, right? I mean, he, became a little bit of a cult hero. So do you gamble on 3 months from Rowdy Tellez, and it was probably because of that IL time with his knee, it wasn't even that, and say, you know, he's going to be the first baseman? Or do you just commit to some type of, you know, platoon with him and Hira and hope you fix Hira? It's going to be interesting. There's a redundancy between Tellez and Vogelbach, so I don't see the value of bringing both of those guys back. Unless we have a DH, you know, only baseball will make us probably wait till April 1 of next year before we know if there's going to be a DH. If they have a DH, then there's definitely a spot for Vogelbach and Tellez on the team, because left-handed power plays pretty good in American Family Field. But other than that, you know, I'll just say first base and right field. Let's see what happens in those two spots, because it's going to be like Kane / Bradley in center, Yelich in left, Urias at third, Adames at short, Wong at second, and then Narvaez, I assume, will be the number one catcher. Manny Pena is a free agent, and they may just say Luke Maley's the new backup catcher, you know, because he fits the same profile as Pena with less power, in that he's a really good defensive catcher, which is what your number two catcher needs to be. But, you know, Manny Pena is 34. So all of us that know Manny hope Manny's back. He's just the greatest guy, and he's become a real team leader. But, you know, we'll see. And I don't think financially it'll be a big thing with him. But they may just decide at his age, you know, to move on. But we'll see.
Yeah, Pena had a lot of pop this year and finished the season strong, but overall, not a great year for him. Backup catchers, you're not really looking for much, like you said. Just got to be a good defensive player, which Pena was. So that could be kind of interesting. I kind of see what you see and think Luke Maley will probably be the guy, or maybe they find somebody else to be the guy as the backup. It's just amazing to me that this team won 95 games with Yelich and Hira being the two bats you got to feature, and then they're basically you know, especially Hira, non-contributors. And they're still able to have such a successful season. David Stearns, the architect of that, again, was asked at this postseason press conference about his interest in the Mets job, or I guess in general, just any other job. The Mets
right.
one is the obvious one.
Right.
It sure seems like he's still going to be here. And I think reading between the lines, that's what we're led to believe here, that he is under contract. He's going to still be here. But it does feel like there's still that specter hanging over. Until that position gets filled, it feels like David Stearns is going to be a name that New York's going to want, and that Mets, you know, Mets fans might see in that spot. So I guess until that spot's filled, I'm not convinced how it's going to go one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, that's when the nonsense will stop. And I think it's more noise coming from New York than it is from Milwaukee. So somebody said, hey, did the Mets really want Stearns, it seems like. And I said, well, people in hell want ice water too, but they're not getting it. You know, it's room service is not coming with that pitcher of ice cold lemonade. The other thing that sort of, I don't think was known, you know, the Brewers are so secretive about contracts with their executives. And this is why they don't want like anybody to know when it expires, so that people don't start saying, well, he's leaving, you know. But I know for a fact that he has one more year on it, and it seems like it's coming out now that maybe there's a team option for 2023. It's odd because you never really think of GM/presidents as having team options. You think more for players, but it makes a lot of sense, you know, to have a team option, because, you know, then you get an extra year to keep him while you try to figure out his next contract, right? Or figure out your way of replacing him. So, you know, Mark Attanasio, strikes me as a best business practice kind of guy. And I don't think it's best business practice to let David Stearns go, you know? So I just don't see him, you know, because they intentionally moved his title from GM to president of baseball ops. One, because he deserved it, but two, because it made any move elsewhere lateral. And sort of the understanding in baseball, JR, is you don't stand in the way of a guy being promoted by another team unless you do it yourself, promote him yourself. But lateral moves are different. Owners often, you know, unless it's extenuating circumstances, they don't feel that compelled to let teams talk to somebody for a lateral move. So, you know, if Stearns wasn't from New York and grew up a Mets fan and had done such a great job here, he wouldn't be the one that gets talked about the most. So that Mets job might be one of those be careful what you wish for jobs.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, Stearns has been to the playoffs 4 straight years. He might have decided he can do all he can do. But I'll tell you one thing, I wouldn't be too anxious to walk out on this pitching staff right now.
Yeah, it looks really promising for next year. Like we said, if that full rotation comes back, if they bring back Hader, they've still got Williams. You know, theoretically, they could easily re-sign a Brad Boxberger. They could re-sign some pretty, you've still got Ashby if you need him as a reliever. Ethan Small is going to be coming up through the ranks here. He's going to be a capable contribution either to the rotation or to the bullpen. This team's got to feel good about its pitching going forward. And you talked about the DH, how that could potentially get factored in very late in the game. And part of that is because the labor situation is so tenuous going forward. We haven't heard a lot about that, the baseball labor situation. The playoffs are going on, and
right.
We just haven't heard people bring it up in a while. We've mentioned it on the podcast here about how, you know, nobody wants to, after what we've been through in 2020, nobody wants to be the side that keeps baseball from happening in 2022. What is your confidence level at this point? Has it changed? Is it just, it's still just a massive wait and see, or how do you feel about that situation moving forward?
Well, I think that they probably have an understanding on both sides to not talk about it right now, you know, publicly, because, well, you know, baseball does a lot of stupid stuff, but that would really be stupid to during your premier events of the year. Let's throw a bunch of negative stuff out there about our bargaining, you know. So I think they probably, both sides have agreed not to talk about it right now. But December 1's not that far away.
Right.
And there's been no end. I'll tell you one thing, JR, if they are successfully negotiating a new CBA without any of it coming out, it's going to be the most amazing thing ever in baseball history, the way that stuff leaks out to the national guys. So I don't know. I don't have high confidence level. Last year, if last year was the opening act to labor going forward, that was pretty ugly. You know, during a pandemic, arguing over how much pay guys are going to get for 60 days and just everything else. And the union has a grievance still standing against the owners intentionally limited it to 60 games, the whole pay down. So they filed a grievance about that that's worth hundreds of millions. So these guys don't like each other very much, and which is, that's not really new. But I think the difference this time, JR, for the first time since Marvin Miller showed up, the owners have considered to have, quote unquote, won the last couple of negotiations. And the players have heard so much about that, that they seem determined to get some stuff back. I don't know how doable that is. When stuff goes away, it's hard to get it back. But I do think that they are going to dig in pretty deep. And so therefore, you know, will that make owners lock them out in spring training? Yes, it will. That's always the reciprocal thing. When players think they're going to be locked out, they go on strike. And when owners think that they might go on strike, they lock them out. And so there's a whole lot of talk now about don't book your spring training condos before April 1st, you know. So that would be brutal. And talk about tone deaf with, you know, what's going on. I mean, we're still in a pandemic. There's still all kinds of labor issues, you know, across the country, and work issues. And, I don't think there's a big appetite from baseball fans to see these guys go at it again. So I hope they don't. It makes no sense to do it. It's very self-defeating. But the rumblings just don't sound good. Maybe they'll fool us. You know what? Maybe they'll fool us. I hope they do. You know, Bud Selig worked awful hard to stop that madness. You know,
Yeah.
and those 25 years of labor peace. Look how much the game has grown over that time. You know, and so I mean, we talk about, you know, should they have the DH or not, and why don't umpires know what a check swing is, and could somebody please tell us what the baseline is? That's the stuff we should be arguing about. You know what? And video replay, you know, what three blind mice in New York are running that, you know? So, but that is the stuff we should be talking about, right? Debating the game.
Yeah, that would be
Not,
nice.
you know, it's the greatest game because of all that crap, if that makes any sense. I
Yeah.
mean, you know, this check swing heard around the world last night, and, you know, just. It's just but those debate. It's like the baseball writers. We catch a lot of grief from who we do or don't let in the Hall of Fame. But I think baseball, the Hall of Fame itself, kind of likes that chatter. You know what?
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, we'll talk a little bit more baseball, bigger picture. We've got four teams in the championship series. Gotta say, as a if I'm a neutral fan, not super enticing. You got the Astros and the Red Sox, two teams that have been here plenty of times in recent history. You've got the Dodgers and the Braves. The Braves maybe not quite as often. They did make the NLCS last year, but just likewise, you know, especially if you're a Brewers fan, don't want to cheer for the Braves.
Yeah.
There's not much here. Of course, the Dodgers are starting 2020 Brewer Corey Knebel in Game 5 against the Giants, one of the great all-time NLDS matchups. And that was kind of a fun little note on their night. The check swing you mentioned. A lot of people are talking about that on Sundays or as on Fridays we record this. But who do you got? Is it just Dodgers? You think it's just the
Yeah,
big bad?
let's see how much starch the Giants took out of the Dodgers. They're awful deep. I'm not guessing they did. Take a lot of starch out of them. They do have to go to Atlanta, I'm sure, in a severely drunken state today. Max Scherzer probably still has no shirt on.
He's shirtless. He's more shirtless than J.R. Smith. NBA legend J.R.
It's
Smith is shirtless.
unbelievable, isn't it? He looks always ready to go swimming to me. But they got a lot of talent. So let's see if they regroup a 7-game series too instead of five. So it's a lot less arbitrary. You know, arbitrary things can happen. Usually the better teams win out over those 7 games. Boston seems like a team of destiny, the way that they knocked off Tampa Bay with all that magical stuff. But let's see if they are, because I think Houston's better than than people give them credit for. They have lost McCullers, one of their best pitchers now, and that's not going to help them. That seems like it's going to be a high-scoring series, and Braves Atlanta seems like more of a low-scoring series. I know Fox wants LA and Boston.
Yeah, I bet. I bet.
But if it turns out to be Houston and Atlanta, it might be just as compelling. So maybe Dusty Baker will finally win a World Series.
Yeah, it's hard for me to get a gauge on how the national media view or national fans view the Brewers, but from a neutral perspective, some of the more interesting and exciting teams this year, Tampa Bay, the Chicago White Sox, maybe the Giants because they just exceeded expectations and now all
Yeah.
those teams are gone. We're just
Yeah.
left with
I
the
mean, both
usuals.
number one seeds didn't make it to the LCS, you know. So yeah, it just has the feel of an odd year, doesn't it? So it didn't exactly play. The Giants, I mean, it's just so wrong that they're not playing still.
Agreed, agreed. And there's only one top two seed because the Brewers, of course, were a two seed in their own right. They don't make it. Only one top two seed. Granted, that's caveat, because the Dodgers won 106
Right.
games. You know, they're still a juggernaut.
It's
But
two awfully good wild cards, isn't it? Boston and LA.
yeah, it really is. It really is.
And maybe that's what it's going to be, the two wild cards. You know, it's generally not supposed to happen that way, but those teams were awfully good. And they were in tough divisions where everybody was good. I mean, you had Boston, New York, and Tampa Bay, and then you had the Giants and the Dodgers. I mean, you had to win a ton of games just to get the wild card. You know, so
Yep.
I'm just so I'm going to just say the two wild cards play. It just has that feel of a weird year.
Much to the delight of MLB executives, as you mentioned.
Yes.
That's your unofficial pick for now. Any last thoughts before I let you go?
No, I think that covers it. David Stearns, just right out of the chute today, said that This is probably their most disappointing exit ever because they did think they had the pitching. But I think we just see now you got to have some offense too. It can't just be. I know the Giants and the Dodgers just played a 2-1 game, but in general, you got to have some offense. And so let's just see if the Brewers can get that figured out. I do think it's the best pitching they're ever taken from one season to the next.
Yeah. He is Tom Haudricourt, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Find everything he has at jsonline.com. Throughout the offseason, you've been through a baseball offseason before. There's always something going on, and we will podcast as necessary, but we're not going to do the week-to-week thing for a while. Hopefully there's baseball on the other side of December 1st, that baseball on the calendar in some way, shape, or form, and things go pretty smoothly. Thanks for joining us, Tom. We will chat with you again very soon.
Thanks, JR.
Thanks for tuning in this season to the Milwaukee Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast. Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating and review, and we will be back with you as soon as news warrants. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.